Blog Talk Radio. At the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett. I want to welcome the callers and chatters to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. You can join me every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, where I will have a wonderful lineup of experts who will share resources, stories, and answer your burning genealogy questions. All of my guests share a deep passion and knowledge of genealogy and history. If you have logged in as a guest and you wish to participate in the chat, you can sign in through your Facebook account. I will also open the lines in the second half of the show so that you can call in and ask questions of the guests. Well, to kick off Black History Month, I would really like to challenge all of the listeners to consider researching and honoring a family member. I have shared with many of you a photo of my grandmother, who lived to be almost 106 years old. Her birthday is Saturday, and from my calculation, that would make her, I guess, around 117 years old. I feel so fortunate to have known such a wonderful person who shared so many stories with me, and I give her all of the credit for making it easy for me to research my maternal family's history. She did not throw away a thing, and I am so privileged to have in my china cabinet today a wedding gift she received in 1913. I also have World War II letters from her two sons, and I even have a letter that she wrote to her aunt in 1961, telling her aunt that she had the old family Bible, of which is in my possession right now, and that her birthday was in that Bible, and that she was 63 years old and eligible for Social Security. Oh, the stories make genealogy come to life. And my guest tonight has also made her research come to life by going through a wonderful journey and writing a book about her ancestor, Miles Lassiter. Margot Lee Williams was born in New York. She holds an M.A. in sociology and an M.A. in religious education. She developed an interest in genealogy early in life. But only after moving to Washington, D.C., did she actively pursue family research. In the 30-plus years since, she has researched and written extensively on her family. She is a well-known lecturer for the Family History Centers of the LDS Church in the Washington, D.C. area, a former editor of the Journal of the Afro-American Historical and Genealogical Society, and through her private research company, Personal Prologue, has developed expertise in identifying heirs for the interstate probates. She is currently a National Service Officer with the Vietnam Veterans of America. So let me give a warm welcome to Margot Lee Williams to research at the National Archives and Beyond. Margot?
Good evening.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, you know, I read your profile, and it said that you developed an early interest in genealogy. So what motivated you to get involved in genealogy?
Well, actually, started on my father's side. My father's sister, she was very interested in the family history, and she'd kept all the stories. And I was the first one to come along who had an interest in hearing those stories. So she would tell me all about the family history, who was whom, complete with, I call it, biblical begats. She would write it down, and she'd say, this one begat that one. And I thought it was just totally fascinating, and I would ask my mother then about her family, and she said she just didn't know that much, but she had a few stories, which is where I begin the book.
Okay, well, why don't you provide us, with your key research strategies? Just how did you begin this book?
I really began it with the story of my mother's great-grandmother, whom we call Grandma Ellen. And she would tell me about Grandma Ellen and where she lived, and that she had a big house, and it was up on a hill. I was curious. I knew that you needed to find information about vital statistics. I needed to find out who her parents were. So I sent for a death certificate, and lo and behold, it gave me the names of Nancy Lassiter and Calvin Dunson.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked my mother if she knew anything about them. She'd never heard anyone by that name, never heard of anyone by those names. And so I began to try and figure out who these people were and where. I knew that they lived in Randolph County, North Carolina, in the Asheboro area, but I mm-hmm. needed to find out more about them. Who were their siblings? Who were there other children in the family? Who were their parents? I didn't think that I would get very far to start with, but I was actually pleasantly surprised.
Now,
I got back
to
Miles
to
very quickly because
together.
I went to, as a matter of fact, I did go to the National Archives, and very quickly mm-hmm. in the census was able to find Nancy in the home with Miles, but that didn't tell me much. Now I had to go outside the National Archives.
Mm-hmm. So keep telling us what else
happened. Well, I knew that Grandma Ellen owned property in Asheboro, and my mother had described the home and so forth. But when I tried to find deeds, I discovered that that wasn't the land that Grandma Ellen owned. That land belonged to her husband, her second husband, Charlie Mayo. Her land was in the country outside of Asheboro in the area called Lassiter Mill. And on those deeds, it said, part of the division of lands of Miles Lassiter. Well, now I knew that there were other people involved in dividing up this land when he died, so theoretically other siblings. And I knew that there was potentially a probate record. So now I was off to look for the probate record. But unfortunately, no one seemed to know anything about the probate record. So I floundered around for quite a while trying to figure that out when one of the county historians that I had befriended and was helping keep an eye out for me discovered a probate in the name of someone called Healy Phillips. Mm-hmm. And she named Nancy Lassiter as one of her descendants, one of her heirs. And the land that was discussed in that probate matched up with the land that I had identified in the deeds from Grandma Ellen. So now I was off and running.
Well, can you give us an idea, what time frame are we looking at? Are we in the 1870s or the 1820s? Where are we? Where are you?
Well, Grandma Ellen was born in the 1850s, in the early 1850s.
Okay.
You know, the number tends to slide a little bit, as we know in
mm-hmm.
genealogy.
But
oh, yeah. Approximately 1852 she was
okay.
born.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And her mother was born in the 1820s. That's
okay.
Nancy.
That's Nancy.
And Miles, Nancy's father, was born about 1777, I've estimated.
Oh, my goodness.
So it got me right back to the colonial period, to the American Revolutionary period.
Now, how long did it take you to, after you found, you said you found the marriage record, and it just, you went to the National Archives. You
no,
found
no, I
the
found the death record. I got the death certificate for Grandma Ellen. Fortunately, she died within the period when North Carolina had finally said we have to have death certificates. You know, in many of the states, particularly in the South, vital statistics were not kept until fairly late. North Carolina began around 1915 time period.
Mm-hmm.
And so Grandma Ellen died in 1920, bless her heart.
Okay.
And so I was able to get the death certificate. If she had died too much earlier, I wouldn't have had much luck from that. There may have been something else, but I wouldn't have
mm-hmm.
had any luck from that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what gave me the first clue as to what direction to go in terms of the Lassiters. No one, my mother had no idea that there were any Lassiters in the family.
Amazing. That is wonderful. So you have traced Miles. He was born in around 1777.
Correct. And he disappeared from the records after the 1850 census. From the census records. He didn't show up again in 1860, and I did surmise that he had died in the meantime. But because at that point I realized he was an elderly man, and it was entirely likely. But I didn't know much more about it than that at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew that in order to... So my strategy was at that point to identify who was involved in the family was to really look at the land records and to go through the land records and to trace the land records. And that led me on a very interesting journey with regards to Miles.
Okay. Why don't you share with us?
Okay. Because I discovered in 1815 he bought 100 acres of land. And that was pretty interesting for a black man in North Carolina to be buying 100 acres in 1815. But then he seemed to sell it in 1826, but oddly enough, the dimensions of the property, the description of the property, seemed to match a description of property that is still in the family. So now I was trying to figure out, he bought it, he sold it, but we still have it.
Mm-hmm. So who did he sell it to?
He sold it to a man by the name of Henry Newby.
Okay.
And Henry Newby will become sort of a critical piece of information a little later on in the story. At this point, I was just sort of collecting information, trying to collect as many pieces of information as I could, and then try and figure out, you know, it's sort of like, okay, here are all my puzzle pieces, and then I can put them together. Do I have all my puzzle pieces? Well, I knew that I didn't have them all, so I had to go find them. And I began looking in court records as well. And
mm-hmm.
I started looking at the court minutes and discovered in 1807, Miles and two other men, also called Lassiters, were appointed to the road crew for a road that is for the Fayetteville Road, which the crossroads were near the area where I knew he lived. And I thought, well, that's interesting. But what was even more interesting, it didn't actually say what race he was. It just listed his name, and it listed these two other men, both
mm-hmm.
of whom, Jack Lassiter and Samuel Lassiter, both of whom I had seen living either near him or with other relatives later on. And so I knew they were black, but it didn't say they were black.
Mm-hmm.
Now I was really curious.
Now, how long did it take you to go through these records? I mean, yes, this is quite curious. I can imagine.
Oh, you know, I spent many, 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 many hours. I used to make jokes about my date time was with microfilm readers. That was my boyfriend, and I was single at the time, and so I did. I spent a lot of evenings after work, and I spent Saturdays and whatever time, I was just totally fascinated by the whole story and as it unfolded. It took many years really to learn this story. I got significant pieces along the way, but to really put the story together, to be honest, it took over 30 years. In fact, I got some of the final little pieces of the puzzle just as the book was going to press, and I had to call the publisher and say, wait, I have to change something.
Were those ancestors just kind of putting that information in your hands?
I believe so. Mm-hmm. I believe so. And that happened a couple of times along the way. Certainly, one of the first experiences of what we could call serendipity was that the book, the how-to book, the specific how-to book that I decided to pick up from, I believe I bought it in Barnes & Noble, had a section on doing African American genealogy, but more importantly had a huge resource section state by state, and it listed North Carolina, and lo and behold, it discussed the journal for the Historical and Genealogical Society from the very county that I wanted to do research in, and it indicated that they had published the slave marriages. And so that made me think that this was a county in which people were interested in African American history and I could really get some help.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, when I called there, I said, well, I'm going to call them and talk to them because why not? And so I called, and the woman I spoke to was delighted to talk to me. And finally, she said, we don't have a lot of people doing this research. I'd love to help you do this research. And besides which,
wonderful.
I think I know what family you're talking about. Here's where they live.
Oh. Great.
So I picked up the phone in those days. In those days, you picked up the phone and you dialed information and you asked for people's phone numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of different now. And so I did, and I called the house and I said, hi, I'm really interested in Randolph County history. And we talked for a while, and I said, I have to confess, I'm interested in your family history, because I think it's my family history. And they were shocked because they hadn't heard of my mother either.
Mm-hmm.
My mother didn't know who they were, and they didn't know who my mother was.
Mm-hmm.
But they were very excited at the idea when I explained what I thought the relationship was, and they said yes, they knew who those people were, Nancy and some of her other children, Grandma Ellen and a sister of hers, Adelaide. And so they were so excited, they invited us to visit them. And I tell about that driving down that first time to visit them. That's part of how I launch into the story in the book.
And this is before you actually found out more information on Miles.
Yes.
That you met the family.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Actually, at that point, I had seen in Henshaw's, because I would open things randomly. If it had to do with North Carolina, I'd just open it up and read through it. So,
mm-hmm.
excuse me, I opened up Henshaw's, because I did know that there were a lot of Quakers in the community. And
mm-hmm.
so I just randomly opened Henshaw's Encyclopedia of Quaker History and Genealogy, and oddly enough saw that in Randolph County there was a Miles Lassiter who requested membership in the Back Creek monthly meeting. And I thought, wow, that's interesting, and somebody with the same name. But as I went along and when I asked the family about that, they said, well, they weren't sure about Miles, but they knew his son had been very active in the Quaker meeting, his son Collier, their grandfather, and
mm-hmm.
so who was Nancy's
mm-hmm.
brother. And they
mm-hmm.
said, yes, they knew that, and they knew he was even buried in the Quaker cemetery. And I said, oh, so now I needed to look in Quaker records to see if there was anything that I might learn. And I contacted the Friends Historical Society and the Friends Historical Collection, actually, at Guilford College. And they were very excited because they recognized the name, but they didn't know he was a black man. For the very reason that in the minutes, they told me in the minutes for that meeting, although they saw his name, it never mentioned that he was a black man. And they thought I was crazy. So they double-checked my research. And they wrote back and said, you're right. He is a black man. And, yes, he was accepted into the meeting. And they, I didn't actually at that time see the minutes. They copied out the minutes, the transcript. They transcribed the entries for me and sent them to me.
Well, Margot, since many of us may not be familiar, just familiar with the process of becoming a Quaker, would
mm-hmm.
you provide us with a brief historical context of what it meant for a black man to receive full membership as a Quaker?
Let me just briefly say that Quakers began in England. Their founder is considered to be George Fox, and that has another interesting connection to my life. But George Fox, and he brought it to the States and, well, to the Americas, and was an itinerant minister. And one of the things about, they're called officially called the Society of Friends, and
mm-hmm.
one of the things about the Society of Friends is they're less focused on theology and more focused on, I guess, what we might call in other areas of Christianity, discipleship. So they're more interested in what you do with your life. Obviously, you believe in God and they believe in Jesus Christ, but they're not into the nuances of what that's supposed to imply theologically. What they do see is that Jesus went out and healed the sick. He took care of those who were in need. He cared about the poor and so forth, and those who are mistreated in life. And so they
mm-hmm.
believe that they should be doing the same things,
mm-hmm.
which has meant that Quakers are, and the quaking, the reason they're called Quakers is because they sit in silence in their, what they call meetings in their worship services, waiting for the Spirit to speak to them. And it at the time, and this was a time when there was a great spiritual awakening going on in general, and
mm-hmm.
it was not unknown for people to be very emotional, and so this emotion would overcome them, and you would see them visibly quake or shake, and so that's how they came to be known as Quakers.
Interesting.
Affectionately. So, but they were very involved in social justice issues, and they were very involved in, they became very involved in the abolitionist movement, as most researchers do know that they, many of the Underground Railroad masters, station masters, were Quakers.
Mm-hmm.
However, as a book that was recently published by, I can't think of both people's names. One woman is Vanessa Julie or July.
Yeah.
The book is called Fit for Freedom But Not for Meeting. Despite their support of freedom, they were somewhat reluctant to allow black people to be fully members in the Society of Friends. And I
mm-hmm.
haven't really found anywhere why that is, just that it is.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of antebellum North Carolina, there was a man, Isaac Linegar, in the late 1700s, actually somewhat contemporary to Miles' birth, who requested to be, he was in Guilford County, which is, the county seat is Greensboro, people will know that. He requested membership, and they hemmed and hawed about it. And they hemmed and hawed about it all the way up to the North Carolina yearly meeting. It went
mm-hmm.
up all the different levels, and it took over 2 years. And their precise concern was that he was a black man. And what made it really unusual, they felt, about Miles was that nowhere could they ever find a discussion of his color.
Mm-hmm.
He requested membership in March
mm-hmm.
of 1845, and he was granted full membership in June of 1845, end of story.
Very interesting.
He went on within the meeting. He was given, you know, certain, you could tell that he was considered someone to be respected. His opinion was considered to be respected, and he was mentioned a couple of times. Nothing that you would call earth-shattering, but clearly the idea that he would be mentioned indicated that people thought he was a respectable gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
And when he died in 1850, in June of 1850, a two-column obituary appeared in Friends Review, which was a major journal of the Society of Friends.
Mm-hmm.
And they recounted his life story. They said that and that's where I finally got my answer about exactly who he was, because it was through my research it was consistently unclear that mm-hmm. was he a slave or was he free? For the most part, it seemed like he was free, except in 1840 he was being sold to his wife from an estate, and I was totally confused. So the obituary cleared that up finally, and it said that his owner had died when he was just a baby, and he was, according to the owner's instructions, they said in the owner's will, that the will doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately. In the will, it said that he was to be given to the wife and to stay with her until she died, and then uh-huh. he would be sold at the estate sale. And he was bought for all of 50 cents at that point by his wife. Mm-hmm. And the reason being, he was at that point elderly, and he had had an accident, fallen off a horse and injured his arm very badly, so that it was mm-hmm. somewhat useless, and so he was considered, I guess you could say, enfeebled and or invalided, and so he obviously his dollar worth was way down at that point.
Mm.
But the other two gentlemen that I mentioned earlier who were seen in records with him, Jack Lassiter and Samuel Lassiter, were also sold at that time, the three of them, and Jack went to Miles' son, Collier, and mm-hmm. but Samuel went to another Quaker because apparently Samuel was a bit of a rebel and had run away at some point to Raleigh, and it had cost them a little bit of money to get him back, and so they needed to square the books on that. But apparently he really never stayed in Mr. Cranford, who's the gentleman who bought him, never stayed with him after that. You could find him in all the free records after that. So from 1845 on, basically the family was free, totally free.
Totally free.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt about it. You have
no doubt about it. Excuse me, 1840 on, totally free.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
The other unusual thing about Miles is his wife, Healy Phillips,
mm-hmm.
Was actually a free woman. And there were a lot of restrictions for free people to be married to slaves, so it is very interesting that he was married to a free woman.
That is very interesting. Now, there's a question coming out of the chat, and they would like to know if you could tell them about any good sources for research in Quaker families, and I may pronounce this wrong, but Nansemond County, Virginia?
Hinshaw's encyclopedia covers several states, and I don't know if it covers Virginia, but I would check with the Friends Historical Collection at Guilford College to ask them. Also, I would check with the Historical Collection at Swarthmore, because I understand that Swarthmore has the records for Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back on, and I'm going to open up the lines for those who may have questions, and we'll continue to have this discussion. Just a quick break, okay? At the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Bennett. You're listening to Margot Lee Williams as she shares a fascinating journey of how she discovered Miles Lassiter and his Quaker roots. Well, it looks like we already have someone calling in with a question. And for any of you who would like to ask a question or make a comment, please call 646-200-041 and press 1 to speak to the host. When I see your number, I'm going to call out your area code, and then you can speak, okay? The first caller is 540. Do you have a question? You're live, 540.
Hi, good evening. Hi, Margot, it's Angel. How are you?
Hi, Angel.
Hi, Margot, my question, how much legwork did you really have to do? Because I'm having a problem trying to find different ones in Maryland. And I was told that I probably will have to go into Maryland around Pocomo, Kingston, because I have the copies of the census from 1910 and 30 and 20, but people just seem to disappear after that and I can't find them.
Obviously, it will vary from research project to research project, but yes, it can take a fair amount of legwork. You may have to actually travel into the areas and see if you can meet with people who have sort of the history of the area, who know the history or who know the people who know the history, and sometimes it can mean almost going from door to door. I went to North Carolina and still go to North Carolina 3 or 4 times a year. Not all of those trips are devoted to research, but I'm usually talking to people and trying to collect as much new information as I can. In addition, as was mentioned in the beginning, I've used the Family History Centers and their microfilmed records extensively in conjunction with my trips to North Carolina, and I spend a lot of time on the phone.
Okay, because I was told that there was a place in Maryland that they used to call Jacksontown.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was around Kingston area, Pocomo, Chrisfield area. So when I went to research that, and I'm like, oh, no, they call it Blackfeet Town. I'm like, okay, so I guess I'm going to have to just really go down there?
Possibly. In your case, I would recommend you get in touch with Dave Holland and talk with him. That's down in his... Dave Holland and Mary Hope Billings.
Oh, I know him.
Yes,
yeah,
I know. I know you know them. And I think you should talk with them because that's the area that they come from and they know a lot about the history down there.
Yeah, because they said that they knew of the family where they were.
Okay.
You know, so I was thinking, well, since I can't really find anything else because they said that the Jacksons, there was 18 of them, and the oldest 7 married into the other family called Moores. And when the mother and father died, the younger ones were taken off because they were afraid to go into the orphanages. So they ended up in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
But the younger ones really don't remember any of that. You know, and the last one passed away, in 2000, the last Jackson.
Well, this, again, may necessitate going into court records because there may be some proceedings that surrounded the deaths of the parents and some questions as to how the children would be dealt with. And I actually have someone who was very familiar with Maryland records, and we'll talk offline, and I'll get some information and see what he can tell us.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, and I'll talk to you later.
Okay, hon.
Okay. Thank you, Colin.
Thanks for calling in.
Bye.
You know, one of the things that you've brought, just keep repeating over and over again, is that there comes a point in your research where you will have to actually go to the home place and do some research right there in the county courthouse. It seems like it's one of those essential things that's definitely necessary. But you also brought up the fact that you got on the phone.
Yes.
And you made calls.
I'm very big on that.
I am too.
I've done it many times, and I'm in the process of trying to do it again because I've Miles' oldest son went out to Indiana, and with, as a matter of fact, with the Henry Newby that I mentioned earlier, and I've discovered the name of a descendant that I believe is still living and is living in Indiana, but unfortunately I couldn't get a phone number, but I'm going to figure out how to get a phone number.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have some questions coming out of the chat for you.
Sure.
One is, do you know of a story of the Quaker prophet who convinced the Quakers to reject slavery? Have you heard of that?
Yeah. The specific person who convinced them?
Yes.
No, I had not heard of a specific person.
And then there's another question. Are there any additional African-American Quakers found to have been on record in any other places?
Oh, absolutely. In the North, there were several African-American Quakers, probably among the most notable being Paul Cuffey from New England, from Martha's Vineyard. And he's a very celebrated seafarer, and the Cuffeys are well known. And he was an African American Quaker. One of the others would be Bayard Rustin. Rustin was from a Quaker family on his maternal side. His paternal family was AME, African Methodist Episcopal, but he was actually raised primarily by his Quaker grandmother. So from in the North, it was not truly an uncommon thing. In Philadelphia and Boston, New York, you could find African American Quakers, but in the South, it was. There were still these, you know, half-hearted. They were happy to see that they got free. They were happy to help protect them from being taken up into slavery again. They were happy to help them move out west. They were happy to help them go to Haiti or back to Africa, to Liberia. But they just couldn't understand how they could be integrated into their own communities.
Now, what makes this research unique?
I always thought, really, it's unique. It was a unique story, certainly in terms of my considering making sure it was published in the mainstream, because he was a Southern pre-Civil War Quaker. But for me as a researcher, it was far more unique to be trying to sort whether he was slave or free. I found that to be fascinating, and what that implied about what life was like in Randolph County.
Well, you know, I was looking at your book, and there's a really wonderful statement here, and it just states, "This work reaffirms Margot Williams' commitment to excellence and perfection, both as a researcher and as a historian. The reader is made part of the story, not only in place but in time. But, most importantly, she reasserts the point that, by and large, the information is available to the researcher. All one has to do is to look for it. A job well done." And this was from V.L. Skinner, Fellow Maryland Genealogical Society.
Yes.
All you have to do is look. Would you say that?
Well, as a matter of fact, my comment back to him was, it's really not that simple. And he said, yes, I know. But the point is, you keep looking. And that was really what he was trying to say. He said, well, I want to tell people that you have to keep looking. And even after you think you've turned every stone over, you have to keep turning stones over. And I would agree with that. Now, is it true that you will always find everything? No. But you can often find way more than you anticipate, even when you've gotten to the point where you say, well, that's it. I don't see how I'm going to find anything else. And if you just keep an open mind and you keep sort of looking for any little kernel, anything that just might be available in terms of information, you can often learn that last little chunk that you were looking for. As a matter of fact, I was saying that, you know, I had this last piece of information just before going to press. Well, but in fact, after that, a young woman friend of mine called me up and said, you know, I have relatives from Indiana, too, and I just called my aunt and asked her if she knew anything about your family. Well, guess what? She did. Not only did she know, but cousins of hers had married into the Lassiters, married a descendant of Emsley's, Miles' oldest son.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I had new clues to work on. So I've been feverishly working on the Indiana connection, and that will probably be a new story to pursue.
Wow, Margo, they keep giving, huh?
Yes, I'm telling you, it's just amazing. It's amazing.
It is.
But you have to keep talking. I mean, and that brings me to another topic that I am always impressing upon people.
Mm-hmm.
Don't just do this research and then put it on your shelf or shove it in a drawer or, you know, consider it to be a nice little piece to talk about at Christmas or Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
It should be shared. And I don't care how simple you make it or what you know, it doesn't have to be fancy. It doesn't have to be from, for years I have shared this story. From the very beginning, from the earliest time, I began to put things together and to give copies of it to family members, to historical,
mm-hmm.
to the historical society. And because of that, as a matter of fact, I've learned things along the way because people have seen it and then contacted me and told me that they knew something that perhaps I didn't know. And sure enough, they did. I had a woman call and tell me, or write to me and tell me that she had a deed from her family that just happened to mention Miles and Healy in the deed. And the way they are mentioned, they would never have been indexed in the deed indexes.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have never found that deed. I would have never found that in that deed it specifically states that they are husband and wife.
Well, you've made a really good point there, sharing that information whatever way you can, because obviously if you had not shared that information, you probably would not have heard about that deed.
That's right. That's exactly right. She said she saw my work in the library, and she knew when she saw her deed, she knew she had to get in touch with me. There's
mm-hmm.
no other way I could have learned that.
So
I mean, I could have sat and gone
library.
Through every single solitary deed for the county. But that's not really feasible. And unless and until someone decides to abstract them, and then you don't know how they're abstracting them. Abstractors do, you know, better and some do worse. And so some abstracts are more informative than others. I had
mm-hmm.
no way of knowing that I would ever have found that information in any meaningful time frame.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you said she saw your work in the library. What
yes.
was your work in the library?
I had put together, I have, as I said, I have written the story up. Usually when we would have a family reunion, I would write up whatever my current state of research was and include
mm-hmm.
that along with family information. I would always have a sort of vital statistics area, who got married, who had children, who graduated from school, who
mm-hmm.
died. We would have pictures from the family, from the previous family reunion. I would have the program for the church service. All of that, I put all that together and make a booklet, and everyone would get a booklet.
Mm-hmm.
And then
now,
I would deposit copies of that with the County Historical Society, with
okay.
the local LDS Family History Center, and I usually sent them out to Salt Lake City.
Oh, wonderful. So you are definitely just sharing all over the place.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Great. Now, you mentioned earlier that you connected with living Lassiter relatives, and the way that you
yes.
connected, at first you called them up on the telephone.
Yes, I did.
Tell us about that first meeting of connecting with the living.
You mean on the phone or when we went down there?
When you went down there.
When we went down there. Oh, that was just so amazing. It was, you know, I think the only way I can describe that is spiritual. My mother had not been in North Carolina in 62 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was an amazing trip for her. She didn't think she would live to go back to North
mm-hmm.
Carolina. It had not occurred
mm-hmm.
to her that she would go back.
Mm-hmm.
And so this trip we were making, it was also sort of the first big trip after my father died in 1982. So, you know, it had a lot of emotions associated with it. But we got down there, and we got such a warm welcome. And the cousin that we stayed with, Kate Jones, who I absolutely adored, and she invited us in, and we stayed in her home, and she invited every cousin she could possibly think of to come and meet us, and she took us around to see the community, to see the land, to show us the different places that I'd say, I read this. And she'd say, oh, I know where that is. And she'd take us over to see that. The childhood places my mother remembered, she took us to see those places. We went up to Greensboro because my mother had actually spent time in Greensboro. So we went up there. It was just a wonderful, wonderful experience.
It sounds like it was a wonderful experience also. And you felt that you really connected with these people, although you did not know them prior to making that phone call?
That's correct. That's correct. I did not know them. And it's kind of funny. I guess I could say I really felt that I had made it into the family when one of my younger cousins said to me, don't you remember when we used to come down here in the summertime and blah, blah, blah? And I said, I never came down here in the summertime.
Oh.
And I said, no, that wasn't me. He said, I would have sworn you were down here.
Oh, wow.
So, so I really felt like I was part of the family. And now I spend Thanksgiving with them, with different ones. I visit with them on a regular basis. Thanksgiving in the summer, one of our oldest living cousin right now will turn 99 on July 4th.
Mm-hmm.
And I always go down for her birthday, and then we have what's called homecoming. The family is now became more involved in the Congregational Church. That's a whole other chapter in itself, actually book
mm-hmm.
in itself. And so we have the annual homecoming services the fourth Sunday in August, and I try to make that as often as I can. And I just love going and being with them.
Well,
that is home, and that's
wonderful.
Why I called, that's why I used that subtitle, because it really was a coming home for me,
mm-hmm.
emotionally, spiritually. I always feel, and my mother from then on, my mother and I would refer to it, although as a New Yorker, that's certainly my home too, and I always talk about that as going home. But my mother and I, between us, would say, when are you going? She'd say to me, when are you going home again? And she moved to North Carolina.
Yes, which is really a wonderful feeling. I mean, it's a roots kind
yes,
of thing.
Exactly.
It's definitely a roots. Well, the question that's coming out of the chat is, what has been the reception from the family to the research book?
Oh, they are thrilled. They're thrilled. They love it. And they've
mm-hmm.
been very supportive. Very supportive. And the whole community has actually been very supportive. I did a book signing in November, I guess it was December, because it was right after Thanksgiving. And I didn't go for Thanksgiving because I knew I was going the next week, so I actually went to New York for Thanksgiving. But anyway, I went for the book signing, and I was overwhelmed at the community responses. The family was very interested, but many people from the community, particularly from the Quaker community down there, came out to hear me speak and to buy the book.
Wonderful.
And
now,
I am greatly honored to know that the book is being offered on QuakerBooks.org.
Great. That is wonderful. Now, did you encounter any surprises in your research?
Oh, wow. Surprises, you mean things that I would not have anticipated at all?
Yes.
certainly the back and forth, the lack of identification of Miles and his brothers as African Americans in the records. I found that fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
That was certainly a surprise. It would never have occurred to me that would have been that way. That he was married to a free woman, that was a surprise. That
mm-hmm.
really, they, by the time he died, they had amassed 400 acres. That was a pretty big surprise.
I can imagine that being a big surprise.
And there is some possibility, I am not clear, the original owner is Ezekiel Lassiter. There's been some confusion. People have thought his name was Josiah, but I did find that his name is Ezekiel. And Ezekiel
mm-hmm.
Lassiter died approximately 1778. And so then Miles and his brothers went to live with Sarah and her son, Micajah.
Mm-hmm.
The only known son, now I'm getting into difficult territory here, but the only acknowledged son of Sarah and Ezekiel is Micajah, who, as it happens, had 21 children after that, so he pretty well populated the county. If you're a white Lassiter from Randolph County, you do go back to this family. So, however, Sarah, just about the time, I'm not clear whether it's Miles being born or I'm thinking now it may even refer to Jack and Samuel, but Sarah was charged with bastardy, and the children
uh-huh.
apparently were born live, but
uh-huh.
they can't be accounted for in her white descendants. And my thought is that part of the reason this family, these young men, were so close to the family, and the two families have continued to be very, very close, and I've talked with them about it, and they are not adverse to this interpretation at all.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been very supportive of me and my research, very supportive. So there is some thought that that Samuel and Jack were actually her children.
Mm-hmm. And who was charged with bastardly again?
Sarah Lassiter.
Sarah was charged.
Sarah, who was Ezekiel's widow.
Ezekiel's widow, okay.
And she, Miles, was her business manager for her properties. They had a large estate, and they ran the mill for a number of years, and he was the business manager. That was also a surprise. That I learned in the obituary.
Mm-hmm. You have really found some very fascinating information and facts about Miles and the family.
Yes.
No doubt about it.
Yes.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from the Quaker community?
They're absolutely ecstatic.
Mm-hmm.
They have
and
been very positive. They've been very supportive. When I was driving down for the book signing, I got down there early on Friday and went over to Guilford College to talk with the historian. And when I came in, she said, "Oh my goodness, you have blown up on the Quaker websites." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Everybody's talking about your book."
That is wonderful. Now, there's a question that's coming out of the chat. When one is charged with bastardly, are they being accused of having an out-of-wedlock child?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And so,
yes.
And it's part of a proceeding. The idea is somewhat like a paternity suit, except that it's brought by the state. And
mm-hmm.
so because they want to make sure, in those days, they didn't have some of the social welfare programs, of course, that we have now. And so they were concerned that this child might not be properly supported.
Mm-hmm.
And so the parents had to be identified so that they could be forced to provide support for the child.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the woman was usually asked to name the father, which she could do or she could decline to do.
Mm-hmm. But it was her choice.
That was her choice, but if she declined, then she would have to be responsible. If she named him, then they made him responsible.
Uh-huh. That's right.
And then in these proceedings, because sometimes these charges were brought while the woman was still pregnant, you may see a notation to say that the child was unborn, meaning they were potentially a stillbirth or died shortly after birth, did not survive, or that they were born and have survived and they may be named. And then if you wait a little, go through the records a little further, you may find when they're a young child that then they are apprenticed,
mm-hmm.
again to make sure that they don't become a burden on the state.
Yes. Well, what tips would you offer to others who may be ready to conduct research, let's say on Quakers or for any of their relatives? What would you recommend?
I recommend being organized. I recommend looking into either online or in person, attending some how-to seminars, especially if you're not, if you're just getting started doing this research, so that you can learn some of the techniques, some of the record categories that you know, such as court records or land records or census records or whatever it is, and that you learn about the community that you're going to do your research in. You have to know as much about the history of the community as the history of your own family, because the two together will help you find the records that you need to identify.
And then
I recommend tenacity. It is a long-term process. It is not something that's going to happen overnight. It goes on and on. And so you have to be in it for the long haul, and you have to be in it for the joy of each discovery along the way. You have to smell each rose along the way and enjoy that and use that as your impetus for looking for the next one.
That's right. That's what it sounds like. That's exactly what it sounds like. Well, I have just two more quickies, or at least one more question. How can individuals obtain a copy of your book?
It's, as I mentioned, it is available on Quakerbooks.org. It is available on Amazon, both as a paperback and as a Kindle. It's available at Barnes & Noble, again, both as a paperback and a Nook. And it's available at Books A Million, Powell's, and if you check the publisher's website, you can get some additional clues of places to get it, I understand. As they put it, you can go into your favorite bookstore and request it.
Okay, well, thank you so very much. And Margot, if individuals in the Washington, D.C. area on February the 18th, they can actually hear you at the Visitor Center, the Washington, D.C. LDS Center. So they can actually hear you in the workshop, at least the seminar, is at 10 o'clock. And so those of you who want to hear Margot, that's an opportunity. Are you going to have any books?
I certainly am.
Great.
The books will have to be sold next door at the library in the Family History Center, in the Stake Center that's next door to the Temple Grounds. But, yes, there will be books available.
There will be books. Well, Margot, I want to thank you so much for coming on tonight. And I just want to just remind everyone that our show next week is next Thursday, and we will have Stephanie Martin. She will be discussing research in the Florida parishes of Southeast Louisiana. So if you want to know more about how to do research in Southeast Louisiana, as well as how to collect surnames, she has identified 10 1,000 surnames for this specific region. Please tune in next week. Margot, once again, I want to thank you for joining Research at the National Archives and Beyond. Good night, and thank you so much. Remember, your ancestors left footprints. Therefore, you should follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, research at the National Archives and Beyond. Thank you for joining the show. This is Bernice Bennett. Good night, and I look forward to you joining me next Thursday. Good night. Good night, Margot.
Good night.